Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kingston Reef of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, who explains why he believes the interim international agreement made with Iran over its nuclear program is a positive first step toward reducing the threat of war. Journalist, activist, and author David Swanson, who takes a critical look at a proposed security agreement that could keep thousands of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan until 2024 and beyond. And Mooninam James of the United American Indians of New England, who talks about the National Day of Mourning event his group has organized annually since 1970, which commemorates Thanksgiving from a Native American perspective. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Documents released by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden have led to a diplomatic scandal in the Asia-Pacific between Australia and Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nation. In mid-November, the Australian Broadcasting Company disclosed that in 2009, the United States and Australia monitored the cell phone of Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono and other top officials. The revelation, based on documents leaked by Snowden, prompted the Indonesian president to recall its ambassador to Australia and to suspend military cooperation with its Pacific neighbor. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, Australia has used its embassies to intercept phone calls and data across Asia in order to aid United States-led intelligence activities. The standoff between Australia and Indonesia comes on the heels of the disclosure that the NSA was monitoring German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone. Despite pleas from Indonesia, Australia's Conservative Prime Minister Tony Abbott has refused to apologize for surveilling President Yudhoyono's cell phone. Abbott insisted, "I don't think Australia should be expected to apologize for reasonable intelligence gathering operations." 14 years after he was rescued off the Florida coast by fishermen, Elian Gonzalez, now 19 years old and living in Cuba, has spoken out about the ordeal that exploded into an international custody battle. Gonzalez, who has lived with his father in Cuba since being returned to the island in April 2000, has emerged as a strong defender of the Cuban government. During an interview posted on the Cuba Debate website, Gonzalez urged President Obama to free Cubans convicted of spying in the United States and blasted Cuban exile groups like the Cuban American National Foundation and Alpha 66. He also criticized Operation Pedro Pan, which split up Cuban families by sending thousands of young children to the United States in the early 1960s. Today, Gonzalez remains sad about the death of his mother, who drowned when the boat he was on capsized while crossing the Florida Straits. He blames her death on the 1966 Cuban Adjustment Act, which grants permanent residency to Cuban exiles who can reach U.S. territory. American teens from age 12 to 18 can legally engage in farm labor, including driving farm machinery. In 2011, the U.S. Department of Labor updated its list of hazardous farm jobs that should be off-limits to children under the age of 16. These included working near manure pits, in grain silos, and driving large farm vehicles on certain roads. But according to The Nation magazine, the proposed rules were killed due to pressure from agribusiness lobbyists. Currently, it's difficult to document the number of teenagers killed while working agricultural jobs. There are conflicting databases of workplace incidents and no survey of children injured or killed on farms. Moreover, the Federal Occupation Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, has limited jurisdiction over farm accidents. In Iowa, for example, OSHA can investigate farm accidents and work fatalities. But in other states, such as North Carolina, monitoring is performed by an agricultural safety council dominated by farming interests. Mary Miller of Washington State's Department of Labor and Industries observed, "There is a whole concept of agricultural exceptionalism. It's part of the agrarian myth." Miller points out that agribusiness has historically been exempt from health and safety laws with fewer protections for child labor. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In what's being described as a major breakthrough in the long process of working toward an international accord with Iran over its nuclear program, negotiations in Geneva have produced an interim deal that could lay the groundwork to achieve a comprehensive agreement. It's been more than 34 years since the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Iran in the aftermath of the revolutionary government's November 1979 takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran and the holding of 52 American hostages. Iran and the P5+1 nations, which includes the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the U.S., Britain, Russia, France, and China, plus Germany, signed a six-month agreement that obligates Iran to halt most of its nuclear research activities, providing time for further talks that negotiators hope will lead to a final agreement. Iran, in return, will benefit from a partial lifting of some international economic sanctions that have severely damaged the Islamic Republic's economy. While President Obama has applauded the interim agreement with Iran as an historic achievement, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has charged that the accord is a historic mistake, asserting that Israel is not bound by the deal, while maintaining the right to unilaterally attack Iran's nuclear research facilities. Many congressional Republicans and some Democrats unhappy with the deal are pursuing additional sanctions against Iran that have the potential to derail the agreement. Your reporter spoke with Kingston Reef, Director of Nuclear Nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Here, Reef explains why he believes the interim international agreement made with Iran is a positive first step toward preventing Iran from producing nuclear weapons, thereby reducing the threat of war.
The first thing that I would say is that the deal halts and rolls back the most proliferation-sensitive aspects of Iran's nuclear program. And what that means is that Iran is required to halt all enrichment above 5%, and 5% in enrichment is sufficient for use in civilian power reactors, but it isn't particularly close to weapons grade. So it requires Iran to halt all enrichment above that level. And the reason that we're concerned about enrichment above that level is that Iran has accumulated a rather significant stockpile of uranium enriched to 20%. And the reason we are concerned about uranium enriched to 20% is that while it's not considered weapons grade until it is enriched to about 90%, most of the work has occurred by the time it reaches 20%. So this deal halts that enrichment and requires Iran to either convert or dilute the stockpile of 20% enriched uranium that it has accumulated over the past 2 or 3 years. In addition, this deal stops Iran's enrichment to 3.5 to 5%. And how it does that is it prohibits Iran from installing or activating additional centrifuges, which are actually used to enrich the uranium, and also by, in effect, capping its stockpile of that lower enriched uranium. So while that lower enriched uranium at 3.5 to 5% is not as close to weapons grade as 20%, it's still a concern because it could be further enriched to a much higher level. And so this agreement ensures that Iran cannot accumulate any more of that material. And perhaps most importantly in this deal is that it includes unprecedented transparency and monitoring measures to verify that Iran is complying with the prohibitions that I just outlined regarding its enrichment and its stockpile of enriched uranium. And in return for these, I would say, very significant and meaningful concessions, the P5+1 provided Iran with limited proportional and reversible relief from some sanctions in the amount of approximately $7 billion. However, the much stronger sanctions on Iran's oil and banking sectors would remain in place as leverage to try and secure a more comprehensive deal later on. And the dollar length of the deal that I just mentioned, it would be in effect for approximately 6 months. The purpose of that window is to ensure that while the P5+1 and the Iranians are negotiating a more comprehensive deal, that Iran isn't using that time to make further progress on its nuclear program.
Kingston, while the Obama administration and European Union nations are applauding this deal with Iran as an historic breakthrough, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has branded the accord with Iran as an historic mistake. Maybe you can discuss why you think his objections to Iran's continued enrichment of uranium and the easing of sanctions should not raise alarms with Netanyahu and the Israelis?
Well, it's understandable that the Israelis have very serious concerns about Iran's nuclear program. Since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, the Iranian regime has been quite hostile towards Israel, has not recognized the right of Israel to exist. So from the Israeli perspective, it's understandable that Iran's nuclear program would be of great concern to them. However, despite the fact that I understand Israel's concerns, I believe ultimately that they are misplaced when it comes to this interim deal. And I think in assessing the deal, it is vital to keep in mind the nuclear advances that Iran could have made over the six-month period of the deal in the absence of a cap on its nuclear program and in the absence of the transparency measures, monitoring measures that give us a much larger window into the program that we now have because of the deal.
There are senators and congressmen, particularly Republicans, but some Democrats too, who oppose this deal and are proposing new sanctions that a lot of observers would say would scuttle the entire deal. What is your concern about the role of Congress now in this six-month interim period?
Well, I'm very concerned by the potential negative role that Congress could play. There have been many calls from members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, calling for tougher sanctions against Iran and to pass those sanctions right now. And I think that could very well undermine the ongoing diplomatic progress that's been made. It could blow up this initial first-step deal that we've negotiated with Iran. And we could go back to a situation where there are no meaningful constraints on Iran's nuclear program. So I think at this point, the best course for Congress will be to hold off on passing additional sanctions, to give this deal a chance to work, to see if the United States and its allies in Iran can build trust and pave the way for a more significant agreement. And if that doesn't happen, then we can always pass more sanctions very quickly if Congress deems that necessary.
That was Kingston Reef, Director of Nuclear Nonproliferation at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Find more perspectives on the international negotiations with Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Obama announced in May 2012 that his administration and NATO allies plan to end combat operations in Afghanistan by the end of 2014. But recent negotiations on a bilateral security agreement with Afghan President Hamid Karzai have focused on maintaining a residual force of some 8,000 U.S. troops in the country to train Afghan forces, perform counterterrorism operations, and support the Afghan government in their continuing fight against the Taliban insurgency until 2024 and possibly beyond. But talks on the security agreement that could keep thousands of American soldiers in Afghanistan another decade, extending further America's longest war in its history, has run into several obstacles. While an assembly of Afghan elders, known as the Loya Jirga, endorsed the security pact, President Karzai has said he may not sign the agreement until after national elections in April. In addition, Karzai has specified several new conditions for his signature, including a pledge from the U.S. to immediately end all military raids on Afghan civilian homes, demonstrating a commitment to peace talks with the Taliban, non-interference in Afghan elections, and a return of all remaining Afghan prisoners held in the U.S. military detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, back to Afghanistan. Obama administration officials expressed frustration with Karzai's delay in signing the security agreement and warned that without ratification of the pact soon, the U.S. would have no choice but to leave Afghanistan with no residual U.S. or NATO troops left behind. Your reporter spoke with journalist, activist, and author David Swanson, who takes a critical look at the proposed bilateral security agreement that could keep thousands of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan for another decade and beyond.
People are continually stunned that the war on Afghanistan is still continuing, that it hasn't ended, and the better informed when you manage to impose this information on anyone are shocked that it's bigger now than it was when President Obama moved into the White House. But his White House is indeed trying to get an agreement through as quickly as possible before the April elections in Afghanistan, and perhaps the thinking may go as long as possible before the November elections in the United States, to keep troops there till 2024 and beyond, some 10,000 troops plus mercenaries and support and so forth. Now, President Karzai doesn't want this done in his name. He wants his successor, who will be elected in April, to have his name on it. Karzai is asking for a commitment to stop killing civilians, to stop night raids on the homes of Afghans, to support peace negotiations, to free Afghan prisoners from Guantanamo after all these years, and to not sabotage the elections in April. Those, to my mind, are all quite reasonable demands for him to be making.
David, I wondered if you would respond to the rationale for this extension of time that the U.S. troops will be in Afghanistan under this agreement, and that is that there has been an enormous cost of blood and treasure to stabilize Afghanistan, to keep the Taliban at bay, to prevent them from reimposing their harsh Islamic fundamentalist law on the country, and to prevent Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven for terrorists, as was the case back in 2001 before the 9/11 attacks on Washington and New York. So they say we need to stay there to preserve the current Afghan government and prevent the Taliban from taking over again. How do you respond to that as a rationale?
Well, part and parcel of that rationale is, of course, the spread of democracy. But were we being asked, as we were asked on the missiles into Syria, we would say no. Congress isn't even being asked or asserting its power to have a say-so. The fact that there has been a great loss of blood and treasure is a tragedy not to be compounded. That there are 22 suicides by U.S. veterans of these wars each day, according to the Veterans Administration. That doesn't count drug overdoses from the drugs that supposedly treat the depression and moral trauma. Doesn't count the single car reckless crashes and so forth. So this is the primary cause of death for the type of human beings we are supposed to care about in these calculations, that is Americans. It is suicides. And to continue an operation so that they not be killing themselves in vain is pure madness, if I've ever heard of it. When the troops left Iraq, Iraq remained a living hell, just as Libya is now a living hell. But Iraq is not as bad as it was when the troops were there in heavy presence, much less worse, much less has it become the much greater disaster that was always predicted by those demanding that the troops remain year after year after year. This is an operation in Afghanistan, as it was in Iraq, that makes us less safe at this great cost. So there's not a plus side. Aid would make a difference. Aid has always been very, very little. It would cost dramatically less. And now, in this moment, it's being withheld as a bribe to allow the troops to remain, which, of course, will cost vastly more than it would cost to take a fraction of military spending or of spending on this one war and make the United States the most beloved country in the world by providing people with food and water and sustainable energy and infrastructure and actual aid, as opposed to what we call so dishonestly military aid.
David, what about Congress? There is no intention on the part of the White House to bring this agreement, this proposed agreement to extend the stay of the U.S. military in Afghanistan before the halls of Congress to get approval. But as we saw with pretty wide and deep opposition to U.S. involvement in Syria's civil war, it seems that the U.S. public has very little taste for more war, let alone extending our stay in Afghanistan by another decade or more. Is there a possibility, in your view, that the peace movement, in combination with just mainstream American opposition to another decade in Afghanistan, could result in some kind of concerted and effective opposition in Congress?
Should we manage without the corporate media prompting us, without foreign nations prompting us to, of our own initiative, rise up and demand that Congress have a say, and then demand that it have the proper say, it would take a fraction of 1% of the public in the United States to do that. The listeners of this radio show could do that. We just have to get together and do it. And we could make the missiles into Syria an example to be built on, and say no from here on out to each and every new war initiative. And 10 more years in Afghanistan ought to be a good one to start with.
That was journalist, activist, and organizer David Swanson, author of 8 books, including War No More, The Case for Abolition. Find links to Swanson's recent articles on Afghanistan and other topics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thanksgiving Day 2013 marks the 44th annual Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts, organized by the United American Indians of New England. The event was initiated in 1970 when Wampanoag leader Frank James was asked to give a speech at a Boston celebration of the friendship between the Pilgrims and the native people they met who helped them survive. James submitted his proposed speech based on the writings of a Pilgrim settler, which described the mistreatment of the natives by the English, but was told the speech could not be delivered. In response, he put the call out for native people to gather in Plymouth to mourn instead of celebrate and to voice their demands for self-determination, an end to racism, and since 1977, freedom for imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mooninom James, the son of event founder Frank James, who now serves as co-leader of the United American Indians of New England. Here James describes the Thanksgiving Day mourning event, some of their current demands, and explains why his group embraces the participation of non-natives in their Thanksgiving Day protest.
Well, at noon, we gather on Coles Hill, and we have a speak out where only native people are allowed to speak. And the reason that we go to Coles Hill is there's a statue of Massasoit on it. And Massasoit was the supreme sachem of the Wampanoag when the Pilgrims arrived, and I'm a Wampanoag myself. The speak out might take an hour, hour and a half, just depending upon the number of people who want to speak. And then we have a march. We go down by Plymouth Rock, and I say a few words about how ridiculous and the mythology behind Plymouth Rock. And then we march up to Post Office Square, which is where Metacom's head, and Metacom was the youngest son of Massasoit, who had become chief. And when he was killed, the English cut off his head, and they cut off both of his hands, and they sent one to Boston and one to England, but they displayed his head on a pike for over 20 years in Post Office Square. And after we have the a little gathering there, a little bit of a rally, we go in and we have a social, and over the last few years, we've been feeding 300, 400, 500 people. We don't keep a count. It's just that anyone who needs a meal can come in and we'll feed them.
I understand that the violence isn't all in the distant past, right?
In 1997, 25 of us were arrested basically for marching on our own land. 25 people were pepper sprayed, thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and taken to jail. And after a long negotiation process and in the ACLU got involved, it's quite complicated, we were able to reach an agreement with Plymouth. They dropped all the charges. We have two beautiful historical markers in town, one on Coles Hill that tells people why we're there, why we've been there since 1970. We also have one in Post Office Square that addresses Metacom's head being displayed on a pike. So some of the goals we've been able to get, you know, getting all those charges dropped. We got some funds to start an education project. No individual got any money.
I know the day also includes solidarity with Native activist Leonard Peltier, who was convicted in 1977 of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in a trial that's considered by many to have been completely corrupt.
Well, it's been a number of years. Every year we call for his getting out, you know, clemency, him getting out of jail, because even the government in open court has said that they don't know who was responsible for shooting those FBI officers, and yet he's still sitting in prison, and it's just a sad thing. And every year he sends a statement to us, and we do demand freedom for him. Another one of our demands is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs pay up. They owe billions of dollars in royalties for oil drilling leases, land use leases all over the country, and this money seems to be nowhere. They can't find it. And then again, we also demand that the sports teams stop using racist logos and things of that nature. I mean, I don't like the term Washington Redskins. I don't think anyone would like the term Jersey Jews, if you know what I'm getting at.
So you all are involved in a lot of Native American struggles.
Oh, yeah, we're involved in such things as getting food for the reservations, heat for the reservations, good medical care. I mean, after all, we have the highest suicide rate, the highest alcoholism rate of just about any group in this country. You know, some people have to make the choice between heating or eating. And so we demand things along those lines, because we have people that come from a lot of these reservations and speak, talking about the conditions that they face every day. And believe me, it's not going to a casino and getting a nice warm meal. Sometimes it's just trying to get a meal.
I've heard the criticism that United American Indians of New England is actually mostly non-Native.
I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess as to who's Native, who's not Native, because the people that come support us, whether they're, you know, green, white, pink, the issue is to stand in solidarity. It's really difficult, and that criticism has been raised many, many times, but I don't want to turn it into a Native people-only kind of thing. I prefer to look out and see people from the four directions, which means more to me than whether it's a Native Day or whatever, because years and years ago, we did have mostly Native people show up there, and we decided that it should be expanded, that we should look out beyond just Native people and invite everybody who'd like to participate in as far as march with us. And that the only stipulation that we still hold, and this is the way the elders set it up in 1970, is we don't need the so-called experts telling us anything. We're more than capable of speaking for ourselves.
That was Mooninom James, co-leader of the United American Indians of New England. For more information on the National Day of Mourning event and related commentary, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.